still weird. Growing up there, like, we just ran around and did whatever. And I guess as kids, you never thought, like, something like that would ever happen. And even when I lived up here and got older, you never think that that would ever happen in your town. But it has. And so it's kind of like, I guess it's not the best way for your hometown to be put on a map. But it is. I think the way it's affected me is I'm still kind of in shock, in a way. And that's really all I can say about how it has affected me. I'm still in kind of disbelief and in shock that it's happened in my small little Indiana hometown. It blows my mind still.
Previously on Our Americana. This is Seth Harold, a photographer who was born and raised in Austin. He lives in Western Ohio now, but has been frequently returning to his hometown to cover the drug epidemic he grew up around. An epidemic that's led to an HIV crisis in the small rural town.
See, I got into documenting the drug issues there shortly after kind of if the HIV news broke out. From my understanding, it has started really heavily with Opana, which is an opiate prescription painkiller.
This is Jesse McIntosh. He's 24, and after close to a decade of addiction and multiple convictions, is just now starting to get his life on track.
By the age of 15, I was selling pot, and I think by 15, I was starting to get into a little bit of worse drugs, like snorting pain pills, like Lortabs and Percocets. Of course, when I started selling it, I started trading different drugs for different things, trying to make more money and all that stuff. I mean, that was just the lifestyle of everyone around me.
This is Holly Reynolds, who just 2 years ago, at 18, was the first person in town to actually do something about the epidemic.
To start off with, I'll tell you what Stand Up is. Stand Up was created for high school students to get more involved in the younger children in the community in order to, you know, be a role model for younger kids to not follow in their parents' decisions and find healthier ways to benefit their lives, but also help the high school students realize that they can make a difference if they wanted to.
What you're hearing now is one of Austin, Indiana's prayer walks. They began at the peak of the HIV epidemic, when the media had descended upon the town to cover the story. Local churches would band together and send their congregations out into the poorest neighborhoods, neighborhoods most impacted by addiction and HIV, to hold hands and pray. How does it feel for your community to have a crisis taking place and have your own government ignoring it?
See, I moved from there when I was 13 to Ohio. So, like, when I went back, I almost looked at it from, like, an outsider's point of view. And that was just for me. But then I know some of the other people I spoke to, they felt it was very mixed reviews. Like, you know, they're just enabling them to just continue to do drugs. And then others are like, oh, this is like a really big crisis that we have to take care of. So I really don't know how the community felt about Mike Pence, because some of them felt Mike Pence was doing the right thing by not sending in the needle exchange. And some of them felt he was doing the right thing by sending it in. So it was a very kind of like mixed reviews, you know, what we can call a crisis, an epidemic. I think everyone knew it needed to be taken care of, but I don't think anyone really agreed on how it should be done. And that's just because it's a very conservative area. And a very kind of like superstitious area, that because a lot of those people come from Kentucky in the hills there. That's where their ancestry is. So that superstition is kind of followed. They don't like change. They don't like things that are like new in that sense. So it was all very new to everybody. There was just a lot of mixed emotions and feelings on the whole idea of what Mike Pence was doing and what he didn't do.
Do you think a drug epidemic becoming an HIV outbreak made people more empathetic to drug addiction?
I think for some people, yeah. And I think for others, you kind of get that stereotype, well, they shouldn't have been doing the drug in the first place. So I think for the people with the empathy for people, definitely made them realize, like, wow, this could have happened to me or my family. Brittany Combs, who I spoke to, I remember her saying that she had noticed that about different members of the community, how quick they were to realize that it could have been any one of them, and that it had changed a lot of hearts and minds on the opinion of people who do, you know, abuse drugs. So I think, yeah, I think it did kind of shed some light on the drug users in a way that people were more willing and are more willing to reach out and to help and to be more understanding and not so stereotypical of someone who is an addict to whatever particular type of drug.
How has the community come together to attempt to manage or mitigate the problem?
There's a lot of different little groups that kind of just like popped up to help take care of the problem and to bond together as a community. I don't know if it's still going, but there used to be a group called Stand Up AHS, which was a group of high schoolers who would go into the north end of town where the drugs had hit the worst. And they would pick up the kids there in the north end and take them to one of the local churches there and play games with them and do arts and crafts and feed them food and snacks and then teach them in a kid-friendly manner about HIV and other types of viruses that you could get from certain types of drugs. I think that helped. And then you also had, like I said, the needle exchange program, where you had different people in the community volunteering to go around and pick up individuals who needed to go to the grocery store, or if they had a job, needed to get to work, or if they wanted to go to rehab, would drive them down to Jeffersonville or Louisville or Clarksville and get them to a rehab facility. And then you also had a lot of the local nurses and different individuals with social working skills volunteering with the CDC and really getting involved in the community. So I think in that sense, it did bring all age levels and all different walks of life from the community together to step up and help their fellow human being in need.
I was reading that it wasn't till last year that an HIV clinic actually opened up in town. What were people doing to manage their diseases before this? Were they having to commute to Louisville or?
So the CDC had different types of programs that the people could get and sign up for and obviously get clean needles and do the needle exchange program. And then I believe that there were different individuals. There were doctors going around to the different houses that wanted it, that would help manage the HIV positive person or take them to where they needed to get that help. Because I do remember, I wonder where they opened that up at, because I do remember when I was there talking a few different times about them opening that up and letting them know different places of where I had heard people that are HIV positive, to them where it would be good for them to open that up. I'm not sure where they opened it up at, though. But yeah, that's basically how they would manage the needle exchange program. Doctors would go kind of house to house, and then, you know, if they needed to go elsewhere, they would get them there.
Do you worry at all that with the looming repeal of Obamacare that the issue is going to intensify?
I really, honestly, I haven't really thought about that in that manner. Just from other things that have had my mind so occupied lately. But now that you say that, I could see where that could be a problem and could intensify the situation, because that would definitely affect those people depending on type of what healthcare they have or maybe they didn't have. So yeah, I'm curious. I might need to get back down there and find out for myself what those implications could be.
How has it changed the way you think about HIV?
I think it's definitely made me more aware of HIV and more understanding of it, because, you know, a lot of times with stories like that, something that you're not really familiar with, you kind of are learning as you're going. So I learned quite a bit on the ground, but it has made me aware in the sense of how easy it is to get HIV by certain types of drugs and how you use those drugs. You know, like we have a problem now in Lima where heroin is big and it's being shot up a lot. And the different health workers that I've spoke to here, they were actually worried last year that there was going to be an HIV outbreak in a few counties over from me, like the one that they had seen in Austin. And I had asked him, you know, have you spoke to the CDC about maybe bringing in a needle exchange program if it was to ever get bad? And they kind of gave similar response to where I had got from people in Indiana. Well, we would do that, but, you know, we would get a lot of backlash because people view that as enabled. But what they don't realize is it's like, if you can't keep people from getting HIV in that sense, then you're essentially saying it's okay for the, in my view, you're just letting them, you know, destroy their lives in a sense that could have been prevented. And I think people who from the stories of HIV in Indiana have realized that that stigma of people who have HIV are people is been blown away, in my opinion. I've never thought that way about anybody because I just wasn't raised that way. I think for the conservative people and the people who are stubborn in that sense, I think that's kind of helped shape their outlook on people who are HIV positive, you know, as people that they have to have the right care, the right needs to continue to live. If you don't take care of that for them or get them those needs, then you're essentially letting them down.
It's almost like a death penalty. Like, you did something wrong, so we're gonna let you die because of it.
Yeah, it's a death penalty in a sense, and I don't think that that's right, because the way I see it, no one wakes up and says, hey, I'm gonna become an addict with using heroin and shooting up drugs and I'm gonna get HIV or hepatitis C. You don't know where they're at in life and what caused them to get to that point in life to use those drugs to seemingly to them maybe perhaps make their life a little better. And then when you just condemn them for that and sentence that death penalty to them, it's wrong. It's completely wrong. I just don't agree with people who think that way.
Yeah, I guess my one hope would be that this teaches people that it doesn't start with drugs. It starts a long time before drugs.
Like, exactly.
It starts with education and income disparities. And
that's something I always try to tell people when they ask me about like that type of work is, like, when I go to those places, I go to find out that individual's story. Because like you said, education, income disparity, and then certain circumstances in life that got them to the point to even want to consider using a drug. Why? You know, well, I was sexually harassed or molested. You know, which is what you hear from like a lot of women who have used drugs. And I just wanted it to go away. I wanted the pain to go away. It's not that they just willingly decided to do it. And it's, I guess I just don't look at it when people in that sense are using drugs for that manner of usage. I don't look at them as them willingly doing it. I look at them as kind of going at it and as a sense in their in despair. And they're doing whatever they can to get those bad feelings or those bad memories to go away.
By God's grace, I did not contract HIV. I know a lot of people that did. I didn't do anything to prevent it. I shared needles with a lot of different people. I don't see how I did not get it, but I did not contract HIV.
When all this is happening and you're seeing everyone around you who you did use with contract it and you didn't, how did that make you feel? Like, did you feel guilty at all?
Well, on a daily basis, I just feel like now it's kind of, it's a weird feeling because I believe in God. I've been saved. I go to church, and it's like I just feel obligated to something. Like, why did you not give it to me? Why did I get spared? Why me? You know, I just feel like I do feel bad. I feel bad. You know, I feel bad for my friends that do have it, but I also know friends of mine that did contract it that have got help. They're in, you know, different programs, and they're living their life so happy. And, you know, I've learned a lot of stuff about HIV. I know now, and I, you know, anybody, any of my friends that have it and they want to get help with their drug problem, you know, they don't always come right out and say it, but, you know, you can almost just tell in you know, the way they carry themselves. And I know that the way, you know, medically nowadays, they can basically just keep it where it's basically in remission, and you can, you know, you can function and you can live a long and healthy life if you take care of yourself, you know. At least that's what I'm in the understanding of. Is that correct?
Or? It is correct.
Okay. So I try to stay positive to my friends and everybody that have contracted it. And, you know, I just try to help wherever I can. You know, I was with a group called Project Peers that go down to Austin, and they do a meeting there. And one of my good buddies from Austin that I know lives in Indy now, he went through the Salvation Army just like I did. He has HIV. He goes to that meeting, and I've heard him talk a lot about it. And he is just grateful of his life. He's grateful of his recovery. And, you know, he's really healthy and athletic. And I think of him as an example of if he can do it, anybody can do it. Because I know in my mind, I feel like that if I would have gotten that, maybe I would have gotten help, maybe I wouldn't have, but it would definitely be a lot harder on me. I would think that, oh, my life's over, you know. But that was before I knew all the stuff about it. Growing up and learning about it in health class is just like, it's horrible. You get the Ryan White story and you're doomed, you know.
What's the Ryan White story?
The Ryan White story, you never heard about the kid that caught HIV through a blood transfusion?
Oh, yeah. I just didn't know his name.
Yeah. It's weird that I remember his name. I just remember learning about it in health class. And it was just like, you know, basically my view on it until I learned about it was that if you have this, you're doomed to death. And that's so not true, you know. But I can guarantee you that's how a lot of people feel that haven't really accepted it and tried to do anything about it, that are still in active addiction.
A lot of people say that the problem would not have gotten as bad as it did had Mike Pence approved a needle exchange program when people started warning him that an epidemic was occurring. How do you feel? Because, you know, that I've only read that from journalists, and I haven't really heard that from anyone there in town. What's your feeling on that?
I don't think that... I mean, I don't think that you can blame something like that on an individual, you know? I don't think you can put all that on just one individual. When you share needles with somebody, you know the risk that you're taking. You just don't care because you're in addiction, you know? But he approved the needle exchange. Would it have been... would it maybe have prevented some people from getting it? I'm sure it probably would have. And would it have been good? Yes. But, you know, I understand that people who aren't addicts, that really they don't understand what, you know, what goes on. And the world is just now starting to open up and be more open-minded about treating people with addiction and making it easier for people that have addictions. If you're not an addict and you don't have any addictions, then, you know, a needle exchange just sounds kind of like we're just letting people break the law. And you know, I don't know. I don't know really my take on it as far as – because I've never heard anything about that, about the Mike Pence not approving the needle exchange. Would it have helped? I'm sure it would have. But could anybody see it coming? I don't think anybody could have seen it coming. I mean, you know, as far as the drug goes, you know, it was just like any other town, you know, that had drug problems. You know, every town has drug problems. Every town has people that use needles. It's just this particular town, there is a high number of people, and it's just so acceptable to everybody that lives there. Everybody you know is doing it, so it's not like it's something you have to hide or be ashamed of, you know. It's just a daily life kind of thing, and it's so weird and it's messed up, and I'm so glad I got saved from it. But I guess I could say that I don't really know how I feel about that, you know. I see it from both sides. How do you feel about that?
You know, I think it's hard for me because I'm a bit biased because, you know, I'm gay and I know Mike Pence is very anti-gay and is, you know,
yeah,
written mm-hmm. some of the most anti-gay legislation ever written. And so mm-hmm. that immediately makes me dubious of him and his intentions and his
ethics. Oh, of course.
So I have a strong opinion about him, but at the same time, like I try to remove all that from my mind and think, you know, what if it was any other government official in any other state? And I think a lot of it is, at the end of the day, you have to please all of your constituents. And I think, like you said earlier, a lot of people aren't or haven't been as empathetic or understanding of drug addiction. And so to a lot of people, it does just look like you're enabling a problem rather than mm-hmm. mitigating an epidemic. So mm-hmm. I get it. I do. I think it's unfortunate. And I think I think it's a much bigger problem of doing what's right versus doing what will get people reelected. I get it. And I hate it. And I think it's a societal issue as much as it is a political issue.
Yeah. And I agree with you, you know, I think you said it a lot better than I could have. I think that when you have journalists that state things like that, I mean, it does become political. You in those things, you look at every way possible. To, you know, if you have somebody that feels a strong way about something, you know, they look at any way possible to drag people down. And a lot of times, you know, they deserve to be dragged down, and the things that they're doing, you know, aren't right. But unfortunately, in politics, you know, that's how it goes. And I think maybe Mike Pence didn't intentionally say, oh, well, who cares if they all get AIDS? You know, he just maybe he couldn't see the problem coming beforehand and whatever. And but that doesn't mean I agree with anything that he does, you know.
Yeah. So I guess moving on to brighter pastures.
yeah.
So you're getting out of recovery. You have a D-class felony. You don't have a high school degree. You're a recovering addict. How do you start your life after that? Because that seems so daunting to me.
Thank God that there is an anonymous crowd that is just everyday people that you see on a daily basis. And I guarantee you, in your life and what you do day to day, you at least run into one person who is anonymous and works a recovery program. You know what I mean? It's just like, thank God that I can go to a place where there is a bunch of people like me that live their lives and they're recovering alcoholics or drug addicts. That is what starting over for me, that's what helped, because I went into these rooms where these people gathered and they have traditions and they have different practices that a moral house cleaning and different steps that you take to progress in your recovery, and you do have some help. In Austin, that's one of the problems, is that you don't have any help for drug addicts. There is no help. There's Life Springs. You can go and get counseling. And now I think, you know, just recently since the epidemic, they've added onto Life Springs a Suboxone program, you know, which is good. And, you know, I'm okay with Suboxone helping people. You know, now they've got the Hope Over Dope meetings going down there, the Project Peers, like, you know, I volunteered and did for a while, but only after the fact. So when I moved to Indianapolis, there's a meeting within a 5-mile radius of me, you know, 2 or 3 times a day. And that's all over the city. just got back from a meeting. You know, I try to go to, you know, at least 4 or 5 meetings a week. Now, back to the main part of your question, how did I start over? I really think that when you are starting over and you're doing the next right thing, that it kind of just works out and it really just falls into place. Like, I can't explain to you how, you know, I've got to where I have and been through the things that I have been through, and I'm able to work in and maintain my family without telling you the piece of I've just been blessed by something out there that's bigger than myself, you know, whatever it may be. You know, everybody has different views on that, and I'm not here to preach, but, you know, in my own experience, I've been blessed by something out there, and I have been able to start over. In my recovery, I graduated from high school not too long ago. You might ask, how did I do that? Well, I went to a place, actually it's a Christian academy, and I was able to take some tests and get a real high school diploma. I got lucky and found a job through a fellow that is in recovery as well. The owner of that company is actually an alcoholic and has been sober for like 25 years, so kind of understands everything about me and all that. I was blessed to get straight out of rehab and be blessed with that job. I've worked my way up in that job, and now I'm in sales, which is the highest paying position in the job besides being the owner. And as far as the felonies wasn't an issue going into the job, and I will be working on getting those removed from my record after an amount of time has passed.
I know a lot of people who have a lot of different jobs, and you know, everyone's reality is the only reality they know. But like, mm-hmm. I think of, you're working this crazy job with these crazy hours, and you have a family, and you're going to AA 4 to 5 times a week. That seems like so much.
Oh, it is. It is. And I'm not going to lie to you. Sometimes it's hard. It's hard because I was just thinking about that today. It's like, I am always just going from like scheduling my life from sleep to minute, you know, it's like, well, you know, 12 o'clock at night. Well, if I go to bed now, I can get up. If I get up at 8, I've got 8 hours of sleep. And then I can get up, take a shower, everything within an hour and a half, and then I can be at the office by 10 o'clock, you know, plus drive time. And then I just schedule. My whole life is like that, you know. And sometimes it's frustrating. But I would not trade this life right now on its worst day for, you know, the best day of me out with no education, no hope, no future, no real friends, no support. I'm truly blessed. And then the times that I do get, and I take time for myself. I don't want to make it seem like I don't have time at all for myself. I do. I make sure, because it's very important that you have time for yourself, or it could become just as dangerous as you can slip right back into getting high. But the time I do take for myself is for myself. You know, so just an example, if you were trying to interview me and I wanted to take this time for myself, well, that's my time for myself. You know, we'll have to do this, you know, this time or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, you know, it is hard. It really is hard. I'm not going to say it's not, because it is, but it's doable. You know, do I have to go to 4 or 5 meetings a week? Probably not, but it becomes a part of your life, and when you have idle time and like, you know, when life shows up and you have issues going on, I just know myself, and I know that I need to be doing this, because once you're an addict, you're, in my opinion, once you're an addict and you've been exposed to that kind of life, you know, you can always go back there. It's not like, well, you get a couple weeks clean and you're good. Well, when I'm in a bad situation and I'm not working the program like I should be, then I don't have the ability to just say no. You know, I'm going to do it. And then once I do, I'm back out. And I continuously, until something happens in my life that pulls me back out of it, I'm, you know, because the only thing that got me sober the first time is, well, the only time, the only thing that got me sober to begin with was the fact that I got locked up and I got the chance to be exposed to recovery. And once I got exposed to recovery and I was court ordered, if I never would have been court ordered to this place, I wouldn't have stayed. In fact, even being court ordered, there was a couple times I wanted to leave and almost did. Thank God that I didn't, because it turned out well for me. Do I have to go to 4 or 5 meetings a week? Some people do, some people don't, you know. And do I go to 4 or 5 meetings a week all the time? No, not all the time, but I try to go to as many meetings as possible. And yes, sometimes it gets hard, but, you know, I got to do what I got to do.
You mentioned that today your dad was 30 days sober, and I know growing up in the household you did have exposed you to a lot of the drugs that you eventually started abusing. How do you go to having a normal relationship with your dad after all that?
Well, my dad's really always been my best friend. He wasn't the best dad, but he never, like, beat me or anything. No kind of abuse or nothing like that. It was just more like when I was a kid, you know, he'd say he would come and pick me up or whatever, and sometimes he just wouldn't, you know. And I always just seemed to be his second priority, you know. Always had something else going on. And so my grandpa, which is his dad now, my dad lived with my grandpa. You know, my grandpa took care of him. Even though, you know, my dad was an alcoholic and everything, my grandpa just, you know, that was my grandpa's baby. And I was my grandpa's baby because my grandpa's baby had a baby. So when I was being raised by my grandpa and when I lived with my grandpa, my dad lived there too. And, you know, me and my dad just got really close and we were in addiction together. And when I got help from the Salvation Army, I think right around that time or shortly after that, he got in trouble and he went to prison. So I was out of the program and everything and living on my own when he got out of prison. And he didn't have nowhere to go, so he came to live with me. And my wife is not too happy about it. But, you know, he's got 30 days clean today, and he's doing really well, getting back into work and everything. And he's going to be moving out here soon. But how do I, you know, build that relationship back with him? I guess it's just I didn't hold any real resentment, you know, to my dad for the things that's happened, nor do I with my mom, because I was an addict and I understood why are you an addict? Well, because you things happen and you get into this lifestyle and then it's just, I mean, it's literally a miracle to get out of it. It's not just a decision you can make and then just stop doing everything. It just doesn't work like that. You know, it's you're the devil, you know, or something like that just has you and won't let go. You know what I mean? It's hard to explain. So I understand both my mom and my dad, and both my mom and my dad, we were all in addiction together, and now my mom's doing fairly well. She still struggles a little bit, but she's trying, doing a heck of a lot better than she used to. And my dad, like I said, he's doing pretty well himself. So never really held much of a resentment towards my dad. I went to rehab and my life has been changed ever since then. That was like 3 years ago. I started, you know, I went through the program. I stayed there for 7 months. And after that, I went to a halfway house, stayed there for a couple months, and then I was out on my own. I just recently got married, got a stepson now, and, you know, I got a decent job. And you know, life is well for me now, you know, by the grace of God.
How does it feel for this to have become the story of your home?
I feel like it has always been the story of my home. Ever since I've lived here, when I moved here from Madison around 8 years ago, whenever I left Madison, the day I left, they said, when you go to Austin on your first day, try not to get shot. So we've always been known at Austin for negative, never anything positive. I think it was good. It brought the town a little bit of hope when, you know, people were coming to my house and interviewing me for good reasons. And it's good to hear some positives every now and again, because when you hear negatives, I feel like I'm a strong believer that if people like continue to hear negatives all the time, they're eventually going to be like, well, everyone thinks this of me anyway, so I might as well do it or be that person.
I've noticed in researching Austin, and I guess this is normal, but I think because it's normal doesn't mean it's necessarily a good thing, that you can find stories through 2015 and then the stories stop, almost as though the problem just went away.
Exactly. Whenever something, you know, whenever they found out how many people had HIV in Austin, they make good stories. When good news, no one cares about it anymore, everyone else just kind of leaves until another good story comes up back up in that town. And that's the only time you're going to get funded. That's the only time you're going to get any help. So you have to, I felt like I had to try to publicize this as much as I could to save our community, which it hasn't. Nothing has really changed here.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that the articles stopped because maybe things did start to change.
Nope. Things have not changed at all. My family does a needle cleanup around the community about every 3 months, and our needles that are on the ground are not going down. They're going up. So people are still throwing their needles everywhere.
How do you feel about the needle exchange program?
That's a touchy conversation, but I don't know. I guess the best way I could say about our needle exchange program is at first I was totally for it because I was like, this could help a lot with spreading. And I don't feel like people are educated very well on it here because, like I said, many of the people who have like drug problems, they don't have a television, they don't have a cell phone, they don't have any transportation to get to the place that they need to get the needles, and they're not sure, like they haven't been informed that they're not going to get in trouble for getting these needles. You know what I mean? So yeah, they're trying to do this needle exchange program, but they're not going to the people that need it. Well, I feel like if you're going to try to set up something for a certain group of people, that you should at least try to communicate with those people on what will work best for them.
I think that's what's so insulting about all this to me is people are talking around the problem. Like they want to solve it, but they don't actually want to go and talk to any of the people who are being impacted by it.
Or they want to only help the people. At Austin, there's this thing, it's like, I call it like the good old boy system. And it's just like, they're only going to help their people. So the people they want to get help, get help. But the people that aren't going to benefit, like their family or are known around the community, aren't going to get help. They don't want them to succeed. They want them to fail.
So I feel like there's a bit of an elephant in the room named Mike Pence. How do you feel about the way he has handled things there?
Honestly, I don't feel like I could ever like blame things on, you know, Mike Pence exactly. I feel like when I think about Austin, it's just like we let ourselves down. We've gotten ourselves into this hole, and now we're like, well, we're stuck in it, and no one's going to help us get out. I feel like Austin has always felt like they're owed something. Like we need people. Instead of trying to help ourselves, we need people to help us. So I don't know. I don't really want to blame anyone specifically for the issues that have arisen in Austin.
How do you think the community goes about healing itself, I guess, both spiritually and literally?
There's way too many. I mean, I'm religious, but there's a lot of churches in Austin, and I think they try to push religion into people's lives, but they don't do it in the correct way. For instance, I've helped in many giveaways. When we do give things away, like food and clothing, no one talks to them about like where they can go to get treated or what to do in order to not catch HIV or even about God. It's simply just a giveaway. So these people just show up and get things that they want and they just leave without having any information or anything that may help them enhance their lives.
So I have a question, and I was raised secular. I've never been religious. So I don't, like, I understand it in the way that you would, like, a like any sort of piece of knowledge, but yeah. I don't understand it on a personal level. And so I have a really strong opinion as a secular person about what's been happening. And I'm curious what your opinion is, where the churchgoers are going into the bad neighborhoods and holding hands and praying.
Oh, like our walks?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've participated in some of those. There's not been there has not been another one since the medias went away.
Were those for the media?
I feel like they were almost... I want to... This is just another, again, a personal opinion. I want to say that they were made for good. Like, it really came up. Like, they really did want to help. But it was easier trying to almost put on a show because... I feel like, for instance, I did it for the right reason. I would still participate if they were still going on. But as soon as the media went away, all the churches stopped communicating. There's not been one walk since. And it almost stopped immediately. So, yeah, I think it was almost a show, if I have to be completely honest.
You know, you summed it up perfectly. There's going out and doing something that's actually helpful, or going out and doing something that makes you feel helpful but doesn't actually change anything. And to me, it would be a better use of people's time and energy if instead of going out and making a public show of praying, they were going out and making a public show of outreach and teaching and helping.
I agree. And I still think it would help if people would still do things like that today. But, you know... I don't know. This town, like I said, it's different until you actually have came and experienced it. You don't fully understand.
So you still live there, correct?
I do.
I'm curious why you've decided to stay.
I don't plan on staying forever, but I feel like my job, like, I know you say you're secular or anything, but I don't feel like God is done working with me here. And I've always felt like I'll stay somewhere until I feel like that place in my soul, I feel I'm ready to leave. And I really have been waiting for my mom. My mom's still trying to work with things in the community. We've just now got a program started at a church in the middle of Rural Street in Austin. And the numbers are growing. It's called Club Jam. So I've been kind of staying for Club Jam just to see what we can do with that. My mom and I have also discussed possibly, you know, starting a boys and girls club here. I've thought about an orphanage, a lot of different things, and I just haven't decided.
Tell me what is Club Jam?
Club Jam is like, there's a church in the middle of Austin. It's where in the middle of Northside, which is known to be the biggest part of the epidemic. And they recently built a building. It's called the Jace Memorial Building. And they were trying to start a children's program, but they needed some help with it. Because my mom and I are strong believers that if you reach children and you enhance their lives, it's all about your environment. And if you can get kids old to not do drugs growing up and have something else to turn to, then you have a less likely chance of doing bad. And basically, we teach them about God, we sing music, we play games with them, send prayer requests, we feed them. It's a lot, very, very similar to the program I had going at school. That's basically, it's nearly the same, but it doesn't have as many kids. Of course, we have some teenagers that do help. We try to get some basketball players and stuff in there to help. That's about what it is. About similar to stand-up.
I was chatting with
Chandler Bowman?
Yeah. And he was saying that stand-up had essentially shut down after you graduated. What was that all about, and how did that feel?
It really sucked, because I felt like, you know, Chandler is one of my main helps in a lot of things. And we had worked so hard. We had built the program. We had food. We had fundings. I had went to, you know, meetings. I had the state commissioner helping us out. He was visiting once a month. And I had planned on a new president because we had set it up like president and treasurer so that money could stay good and there would be a leader in the group that would help control everything. Well, when I passed it down to the president, they just didn't take it nearly as serious as the class of 2015 did, and the money just, everything just dropped. So it was kind of upsetting. But everyone was in college, and we had all left at the time.
How do you feel about the people? Like, and I feel like I've kind of asked this a few times, and maybe I just still can't really
wrap. I'm kind of going around the point.
Yeah, well, I'm not kinda... even that, but I think, like, I can't even comprehend the lack of answer, not from you, but just in general. Like, for all the people who complain about the problem, it doesn't seem like anybody's really willing to do anything about the problem. Like, how does that make you
feel? No, I totally get that. Like, I totally am completely with you on this. My family and I have this conversation literally almost every single day. Like I told you before, and this is the only thing that I could possibly explain to you to help you understand, is people in Austin just think they should be given things. Probably not everyone in Austin, obviously, but many people in Austin, you know, they live on welfare, they get food stamps, they get all kinds of things given to them, so they just assume that it should just be given to them. They shouldn't have to help. They can just sit and complain about, you know, living in poverty and having a bad life and, you know, a really bad town, but nobody wants to make an effort to change it. And in order for things to change in a community, you have to have healthy, willing people to stand up and work for a benefit, but the people that do try to change it enable, and that's the problem.
How do you think they enable?
For instance, we have a food pantry. We have like three food pantries, but there's a place called Food for the Soul, and basically they just give people food and then they just leave and they don't have to work for it. They don't have to go to church. They don't have to, you get what I'm saying? Like, they don't have any kind of held expectation in order to do something.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Your problem isn't so much people supporting the community. It's the lack of accountability.
Exactly. We make excuses for the reasons that we are the way we are when it is completely our own fault.
Yeah, it's so interesting because, you know, I'm 35 and I've lived in some rough places or places where there's, you know, huge disparities in income and access. And I still don't know how I feel about that because sometimes I think if I can't understand why someone's in the position they're in, then who am I to decide what guidelines go around helping them? But then at the same time, I do agree that there needs to be some level of accountability. And I guess I just can't reconcile where those two things meet.
I agree. I do the same. I'm the same way when it comes to that. It's like, I will sit here and tell you that we don't hold people accountable, but then I'll be the one that's helping handing out food and handing out clothes. So of course you don't want to see people starve or you don't want to see, you know, people be cold or anything like that. But there has to be a happy medium. Like, I feel like people that have to work in order to pay for their homes should have to do something in order to eat for free, live for free, do things for free. And until we find a good, happy medium there, then it's never gonna be able to fix itself in this community. It's always going to be known for drugs.
So I guess to end, well, hopefully, I guess it depends on your answer, on a positive note, you talked about how the narrative of Austin has always been negative. Now's your opportunity to give it maybe a positive narrative. What would that be?
I would probably say the only hope we have is our high school. We have very, very good teachers in the high school. And basically, honestly, I can't really answer your question on a positive note.
Oh, no.
I'm trying my best to, like, help you with a positive, but it's like,
well, so
the more I'm staying here, the older I get, the more corrupt I see this town. And I want to say we have a positive and things are going to start going well. But at this point, it's going to take my generation to do that. And I've given up all hope on the adults.
Well, I would say you've chosen to stay there, and that has to mean that you have some hope.
No, I chose to stay here because I had a boyfriend here, and I almost ended up being in the same cycle. And how I figured out I don't want to be it, and I'm in a year lease.
Okay, that's honest.
Yeah, I'm trying to be as nice as I can about this.
Well, thank you for chatting with me, and I am really impressed with the work you have done. And I hope before you leave, you can find someone to follow in your footsteps.
I think, in a sense, all the people's stories that I heard and listened to affected me. There wasn't really one in particular that just, like, stuck with me. I think just the whole experience in itself has just stuck with me. The fact, like I said, that it's my hometown, that those people know me. Some of those people knew me when I was a little kid, and I don't even remember them. So I think that sense, that's what stuck with me, is that it can happen anywhere. And that drug usage and that type of addiction doesn't care what class you're from or what your income is or what your skin color is. It's there. So I think that's kind of what stuck with me. And that has been kind of my push to continue exploring opiate addiction and heroin addiction in photographs. And to continue the conversation, because that's a conversation I don't feel deserves to get buried in the graveyard of the news cycle. It's something that I do talk quite a bit, a lot about with my different friends and family, and then, you know, this conversation now. So I think that's what stuck with me the most, is seeing their stories, seeing my town, and wanting to continue that conversation to let people realize, hey, this could happen anywhere and to anyone.
I'd like to thank the band The Soul Savers for use of the song Revival. I'd also like to thank all our Patreon supporters. You can support the podcast at patreon.com/ouramericana. Any profit margins will be donated directly to the AIDS Healthcare Foundation, which is funding the Austin, Indiana Free HIV Clinic. We've had quite a few new Patreon sponsors this month, so I'd like to thank them now, starting with Vicky Russell, Mixter Hyde, Paula Kimes, Sarah Stapleton, Vanessa York, Jen LaPoya, Heather Marie, Nicole Gross, Abigail Altabeth, Jennifer Menges, Renee Carroll, Nikki Thatcher, Jennifer Paluzzi, and Stacy Puckett. Thank you. The show sincerely would not exist without all of your support. Next time on Our Americana, we return to the open road and catch up with some old friends.